Hello and welcome to the new Not Alone podcast. Everything's zany all the time. Hey everybody, how you doing? It's Sam and Jason in the morning. No, that's not who we are.
Why did you get my hopes up?
That's not who
just
we are.
Just to crush them.
We are still. This is the new Not Alone.
Do you know how much I've been wanting to do a Troy and Ovid in the morning segment?
A zoo. What's it called? A zoo crew? A shock jock?
Sure. Yes. That.
All right. Do it. Kick it off.
No. Now
if it's good, I'll keep it
prepared.
In. If it's bad, I'm taking it.
No.
In.
Let's just go like normal.
Okay.
I can't handle the pressure.
And that's the thing. This is the new Not Alone. Sounds a lot like the old Not Alone. Don't be dismayed and don't be deceived.
These are the same microphones.
These are the same microphones. It's the same me and the same him.
Is it?
But things are... This sucks. Why are we talking like this?
I have no idea. Hello, everyone. That's Samuel Fredrickson, and I'm Jason Moitoso.
Oh, that was great. Why haven't you been doing this for the last 101 episodes? 103 episodes?
I do on the Jason specials.
That's true. You do. This is the new Not Alone. It's the same as the old Not Alone.
We're back to Wolf Talk.
We're back to Wolf Talk. That's how you know it's the same as the old Not Alone. Not only are we back to Wolf Talk, but we're back to one of my absolute favorite people on the face of this planet. And that person is the honorable, the esteemed, the beloved, the...
I'm really wanting to say her name in unison with you, but you keep giving her adjectives.
The intimidating, the true believer.
Oh, dear.
That's right. It's Linda Godfrey. Woo! She's not here, though. In any case, we wanted to spotlight Linda and some of her excellent work. One of the things that Linda does amazingly is she gets down with the details. She gets into the nitty-gritty. She talks to people face-to-face. She goes to places. She doesn't just do internet research like me. She actually discovers things instead of second-handedly telling us all about them. And so I've never heard of this topic before. I think that most people probably won't have.
It is quite scarce.
It is. It's not a very well-known topic. And the only way I know about it is that I found this story in Godfrey's new book. And I'd like to just point out, none of this is a paid advertisement. I know some people might think it is. This is the new Not Alone. I'm not doing that. Now, if you would like to purchase an advertisement, please let me know.
Okay.
But I am not going to lie to people about it. No,
I was like, Sam, what are you saying?
That's our business model. But the story comes from Linda's new book. She was good enough to send us an advanced copy. It's called I Know What I Saw: Modern Day Encounters with Monsters of New Urban Legend and Ancient Lore. And it's just about as cool as it sounds. So, as with Linda Godfrey, she's always doing eyewitness accounts. She's always talking to people. She's uncovering things. And we're going to talk about in a little bit later on some of the other topics that are in this book that are really great. But what we're going to focus on for the majority of this episode is one specific phenomena, one legend or myth. And if there's anything I think that can categorize the new Not Alone, it is myths and legends. I think
I would like to let everyone know. I had no idea that this is new.
It, for all intents and purposes,
all it is new packaging, isn't it?
Pretty much every single person,
new and improved.
Every
just
person
has
listening to this podcast is going to be
formula.
Like, "What the hell is he talking about?" It's all the same, and
have,
that's fair from
should,
the outside.
We should repost it as a new podcast and just name it The New Not Alone.
There we go. And we can make the wolf a different color. Maybe this time he can be green.
Ooh, spooky.
Somebody get on that.
Make him glow.
He already does glow.
I mean,
well, oh,
like
glow
in the dark.
Spooky
glow.
Oh.
You know, like a ghostly glow. Did you ever watch Danny Phantom?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's what you're getting
yeah.
at. Okay. The new Not Alone is going to be categorized by me talking about whatever I want, regardless of if it's like a verifiable thing, because I'm sick of trying to verify things. You know what happens when you try to verify paranormal phenomena?
You become me.
You become Jason.
Completely frustrated about everything.
You know
in the
what
world?
I'd never want to do? Become like you. I love you, buddy, in a lot of ways, but not that one.
Oh.
Yep. I know.
That's fair.
So this is a great example of this.
It's not
this
easy.
This is
being
a I'm sorry. This is a great story that has a lot of folklore, a lot of legend around it. And I want us to dig into it. I want us to really see what's going on here. And the story, for those of you who have been waiting for me to announce the name of it for the last 6 minutes, if you did not read the title of this episode, is The Witchy Wolves of the Omer Plains. All right?
And I'm super excited. Like, there's...
Why? You are super excited. I told you about this, really... and you were like, this sounds dope. And I was like, really? Yeah.
I mean, the name alone sounds great.
Yeah, but it does, doesn't it?
I mean, I'll bring up some things that I really enjoy about this story and about these experiences as we go through
them. Did you have time to read all the notes?
I sure did, and your grammar was horrible.
Hey, now.
Your grammar was atrocious during this one.
What?
I read it at like 8 a.m. It made me sad.
I can't believe this. All right.
Did you proofread it?
No, I never proofread it. Why would I?
Yeah, I can tell the difference.
You can look at them, but they're my research. Yeah,
that's fair.
Thank you so much. Anyway, so the witchy wolves.
The witchy wolves. What? Was that not?
I love it.
You weren't feeling that?
Are you
going
to do it every time?
The witchy wolves.
Are you going to? It is good. I do like it. It's kind of scary. They're a legend that is native to the great state of Michigan. One of my favorite states that I've never been to.
Is it because it looks like a glove?
I think what I really like about Michigan is the way that it's two different things.
Yeah.
You have the Upper Peninsula and then the Lower Peninsula, or just Michigan Greater. I don't know how you refer to it. But that is a really interesting thing, in my opinion, that you have this one state that is separated and still contiguous. The only other thing that's that way is Hawaii, and that's just because...
It's islands?
It's islands, so of course.
So I think it'd be really crazy to like live on the smaller upper part that's above the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Just because, like, think of how much lake there is.
It's all lake all the time,
basically looking down at ocean.
Yeah.
And, like,
I know.
That's real cool.
I've seen a Great Lake once. It was awesome. It was from the Chicago airport, I think. I looked out the window, and there it was. I don't know which one. I don't know anything about it. But I loved it. And it called its siren song to me. But I am too afraid of Chicago to move there. Now, according to Godfrey and others who are familiar with the case of the Witchy Wolves, it's a tale as old as time, or at least as old as the Civil War. But
those are two different times.
That's, well,
two different lengths.
Sure.
There's the tale as old as time. It's a Disney movie or Civil War.
Yeah, one or the other. You choose.
Okay.
It's up to you. There's no other
option. That's the one I'm sticking with.
Oh, well, okay. If you want to live that
way. Maybe a little bit more before that.
Now, before we go into the story itself, you might be asking yourself, or me, you could be asking me, in which case I'm not going to respond to you, what exactly is a witchy wolf? Now, at its essence and its purest form, the witchy wolf seems to be a primarily spiritual being, although it seems to have some physical components as well. Now, they are thought to be the spirit guardians who haunt the grave sites of the fallen Chippewa warriors. Now, the witchy wolves are said to be the most active in an area known as the Omer Plains on the eastern shore of Lake Huron. The plains themselves are a few miles west of the small town of Omer in Aranac County. Now, Omer proclaims itself as the smallest city in Michigan with just 313 inhabitants, and yet people from all around, primarily teenagers, frequent its more isolated areas in search of a tale that proponents claim go back at least as far, like we had said, as the Civil War. This is the story of the Witchy Wolves. This is the legend. Now, what I really like about the Witchy Wolves is that there's two diverse strands of thought here, as we're going to be seeing momentarily. The first one is this really well put together, like, legend of origin. And then the other is just this traditional idea. And that's what I really enjoy about it, as we'll be getting in a little further. But Jason, before we dive into this legend.
Yes.
Anything else? Anything you want to say? Last words? Why'd you just say, oh dear?
Because you brought me into this. You asked for something from me, and I don't know how to deal with that.
All right.
Well, the only thing I do know how to do.
I think after 103 episodes, you'd know how to respond to me saying, Jason? All right.
Sweet.
Let's dive into this legend. Now, the story of the Witchy Wolves.
Witchy Wolves.
Thank you, Jason. You just keep doing
it. That's all I'm doing.
The story focuses on a family by the surname of Keeney, which lived in the Omer Plains region around the 1860s. Now, the Keeney family were homesteaders, expanding into the wilderness in order to have a piece of land to call their own. Now, in 65, that's 1865, a great tragedy befell the family when their oldest son, Corwin, lost his life in a Confederate POW camp called Andersonville. His company, Company H, had been captured at the Battle of Trevilian Station, and it took him 1 year to die in the camp, but it took his family 30 years, until 1895, to recover his remains. And when they finally did, they decided to give him a burial, properly, in a nearby cemetery.
Okay, so hold on.
All right.
Let's break down the story real bit.
Okay.
We have a young, brave soldier.
Oh, see, can you
who gets
see
killed too early.
Yeah.
Then we have this odd system to where it took forever for
took
the family.
Forever for the family to get the body back.
Okay.
Now, right out the gate, this is where Godfrey really, really comes in clutch, because she's been able to confirm the reality of this situation. Regardless of everything we're about to talk to, it is an objective truth that there is an individual called Corwin Keeney who did participate in the Civil War, who died in Andersonville, and who is buried in the Omer Plains Cemetery. There is objective truth that there was a family called Keeney that claimed this individual and that were homesteaders in the region at the time that this was to be taking place. So that's what I really love about this story, is that there is at least a basis of fact here.
Right. And I love the fact that it's the perfect setup for an amazing story.
Good. Yeah, exactly. Sometimes that's how reality happens. What is life but story?
This is life imitating art. Imitating life.
Green screen effect. Well, if we had a green screen right now, could you put us like walking through the forest?
So, Sam, do you want a forest to be going past us?
Yes.
As we're stationary behind a desk?
If we are using a green screen, Jason, I want us to use the green screen. I want us to use it to the best of our ability.
All right, every day. You know what I'd probably do?
Please tell me. And it better not be lame.
I would put us in the back of like a horse-drawn carriage or open area, and then have us going like on a path directly backwards.
Okay.
So that you see the trees and stuff pass us, but it doesn't look that stupid.
I love that, man. I love that. All right.
You're setting me up for disaster.
This is going to be great. I don't know. How are you going to get all this editing done?
My hope is that with the green screen, we can really just like, if we're talking about something that happened in Scotland, we're just going to be in Scotland. We're going to be in the Highlands. So much. Hanging out in the Highlands.
I think what we'll have to do, this is a total side note, I'll cut it from the normal episode. I think what we're going to have to do...
Or just put us in a swamp. Some swamp gas.
Swamp. Okay, I like that. We'll talk more about it.
Okay.
I like it. Okay. Sick. So just imagine us on the back of a horse-drawn carriage going through the foggy wilderness. Now, after a long winter, Corwin Keeney's family went to check out his grave to clean it up when they found that it had been dug up by a she-wolf who was protecting her newborn pups. As soon as she began to snarl at the villagers, more wolves came out of the woods, descending to defend the new mother, and the family was forced to abandon the grave, at least until after the wolf pack had left the area. As the townsfolk reckoned with the tragedy of what had befallen their disgraced war hero, they tried to reason and rationalized these events. According to one Mrs. Gorey, this was no natural tragedy augmenting a unnatural one, but rather this was the sign and symbol of some truly dark evil. This was not an uncommon rhetoric for the time. See, I was able to look up and find a few different references to concerns of Northerners regarding some supernatural element to the South's warfare.
So in that case, do we have a case of skinwalkers? Or do we have a case of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer? Where
I would
the
say
South
neither.
was filled with vampires. No?
Okay. I would say probably neither. Mm. The skinwalker argument is always a good argument. We'll look into it in a minute. I mean, you pretty much have to whenever you're talking about wolves.
Yeah.
If you were it's to, very adjacent. For instance, if you were to write a letter to your local legislator and you said, "Dear Mr. or Mrs. Congressperson, I would like to talk to you about the problem of wolf hunting," or on the other side, wolf overcrowding. You could not write that letter without also referencing skinwalkers. It's a legal thing. No, it's a legal thing. They will throw it away if you do not mention our good old skinwalky boys, the walkers. What if we made a movie, and in the movie it focused on a family called the Walkers? Like, that was their last name, but in reality, they were skinwalkers. This is a good idea.
It sounds like a sixth grader came up
with this plot. This is a good idea. You know what? Children are often very smart, and I am proud to say that I nurture the child within. Typically, the way these kinds of stories go is that down in the South, there's something dark being harnessed by the Southern Army. And really, this is felt and seen most acutely in situations where Northern armies are occupying or fighting in Southern lands. For instance, New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And granted, it is New Orleans. So
home field advantage.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little biased as it is, but there's this idea that the South is harnessing voodoo and black magic and using that in order to fight the good, virtuous Northerners.
Yeah.
It's not something that
even though it's just still America, it still feels somewhat exotic, foreign.
Exactly. It's not something that's just cooked up for this particular legend. Now, according to this Mrs. Gorey, and this is somebody, again, Gorey is a name that has been successfully identified as living in the area at the time. According to her, she was a relatively recent transplant from Tennessee. And in her opinion, the South had ways of making sure that the North suffered even after the end of the war. By partnering with vile occultists, they would regularly curse the bones of Union soldiers. And as soon as these bones were disturbed in any way, they would release a potent curse that went by the name of Scorbutus. Now, the curse took the form of a supernatural wolf, some wicked thing, which would prowl the area in search of blood and victims. The Keeney family, upon receiving Corwin's bones back, did not open up the ossuary, but simply buried it, undisturbed. It must have been disturbed during the rough winter, and now the scorbutus was upon them. So, the townsfolk hatched a plan. They contacted the local undertaker, Fred Mesner, to examine the bones and see if they were human or something else entirely. And this is a weird point in the story.
Yeah.
Because according to Mrs. Gorey, I reread this thing a few times and looked for any outside validation.
Okay.
According to the story, the curse is set on the corpse of the northerner, of the northern soldier, and then it's sent back to them. However, when they enlist the help of Mr. Mesner, they're looking to see if his bones are different than human bones.
Right.
And I don't know where they come up with this idea, but apparently it pays off big because Mr. Mesner says those are absolutely not human bones in this coffin.
So what's in the coffin?
Wolf bones. Which would make sense if the curse was evoking a wicked spirit wolf. But they didn't mention that at any point. And it seems a little weird to me.
Yeah. It also doesn't make any sense that it took 30 years to send them back wolf bones. I mean, like, if you're just going to fake some bones...
Just fake the bones. Yeah. Get it over with. And granted, I mean, 30 years is a very long time.
Yeah,
we absolutely. Do have to remember that, like...
It's almost a forgettable amount of time.
It is. We do have to remember that, like, obviously... POW camps back in the 19th century, their record keeping was probably terrible. Their method of communication was probably terrible. Even finding out what happened to a person back then, I mean, it's hard to sometimes find out now, but it could have been nigh unto impossible. So who
usually
knows?
Infection.
Yeah. Who knows what exactly caused the holdup? But that part does seem to be attested as well. Now, once Dr. Mesner had looked at these bones and said, "Those are not the bones of a good good human man.
Well, I mean, like, you think you'd figure that out rather quickly. I feel like you wouldn't need a specialist to figure out if a bone is human or canine.
Yeah.
I would assume are thicker.
Again,
for one.
I know what bones look like at this point because I've seen a lot of pictures of them. Who knows what they know about bones after 30 years? After it's buried for a winter. I think that calling a medical professional to check out if your bones are cursed, I think that's the standpoint we have to be operating
from. Well, I think it's also just ironic that they called in a medical professional to figure out if something's cursed.
Yeah, and I think it's ironic that the medical professional is like, yep.
They're cursed.
That's not them, not normal human bone, them cursed bone. I know it. Learned in the academy.
Okay.
Granted, doctors were different back then. Everything was different back then.
I mean, barbers were surgeons.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, who even knows? But Mesner is 95% sure that these bones...
Did you just make up an arbitrary number?
I did make up that number. Now, once they decided that these were cursed wolf bones, they did the only sensible thing, which is they talked to the local Presbyterian reverend, Reverend Kay, to exorcise the box of witchy wolf bones. Now, he did so to the town's satisfaction. And it's another one of those things that's like, how do you know?
Yeah, I love it's all right. It's a very white person thing.
It is a very white person thing.
Someone from a Christian denomination can just cure anything.
Reverend K was probably just sitting, having a nice little study, having a cup of coffee, cup of tea, something, and they come in and they're like, "We need you to exorcise this ghost wolf." And in his mind he's like, I was never trained in this.
Ghost wolves.
I don't have any ideas, but these people are looking
like a local
to me.
Thing. I don't know about that.
They didn't teach me that at Presbyterian school.
You got demons? I can do demons.
I got demons. They are looking
to
me.
It's like,
me.
Is that like asking
help.
The clown if you can make some crazy balloon animal?
Could you make...
Here's a worm.
Could you make the elder gods?
The snake.
The old ones from the stars.
That's all I'm saying.
Fizbo.
Anyway, so he...
He exercised it, and again,
but
to the town's satisfaction. Oh, sure. There's a curse, but the curse is currently manifesting in the form of a wolf. So you do have a physical component to this that you can ostensibly say yay or nay on whether or not they're coming back. And it's worth noting that at this time, there were definitely wolves in this area. They then... were over hunted and annihilated.
Yeah, yeah.
I think sometime in the early 1930s, and then they started making a return in the late 90s, early 2000s. But wolves were a problem at this time, and yet they knew this was not just a normal wolf, which is an interesting and weird part of this entire equation that I think we'll look at a little bit later on here.
Well, I've been trying to figure out why a wolf would. Like a mother wolf would even dig up a grave. The only thing I can think of is maybe if that was the only like soft ground.
Yeah, that could
be. And the rest of the ground is hard.
If it's
so,
in the winter, you know.
Yeah, that's the only logical place to dig up a hole. That's the only thing I could possibly think about.
Yeah, because they do have, I'm pretty sure wolves do have birthing dens.
Yeah.
Yeah, they totally do. So, you know, they'd have to have a den somewhere.
Right.
It's a cold winter, maybe... Like you said, the ground had already recently been disturbed and it was ready to go. Who knows?
That's the only logical thing that I can think of. But then what did the groundskeeper do all winter?
Well, I think this is one of those good old frontier pioneer cemeteries where they don't have one of those.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because when they showed up, so this is something that I hadn't actually put in, but it is a detail in the account. When they showed up with shovels and rakes and hoes in order to clear the ground.
Get it all done themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And so that was the only thing that saved them from this pack of vicious wolves is that they came prepared with these gardening implements.
Cool.
So, but again, for me, the question that I was pursuing the entire time I was doing this research is why did they credibly believe that this was something more than just a normal wolf? And the only thing I can find in this instance, in this story, is that Mrs. Gorey says it's not a normal wolf.
And I think, coming back to that as well, it might have been the experience of having a whole pack.
Just come out
being defensive. Yeah. When I think of someone that's probably come across wolves, we're still talking probably packs or outcasts.
Yeah.
So not this whole mother to cub
to the young
kind of kinship. Yeah.
Yeah.
To where the whole pack is defending the new generation.
Yeah. When you look at Corwin Keeney's death certificate or notice of death, I don't know exactly what the document is, but there is a cause of death listed that Godfrey was able to find, and it is indeed scorbutus. Now, scorbutus is not an ancient, unnameable evil. It is not a supernatural slight. It is not a curse that's invoked upon the innocent. Scorbutus is another name for scurvy. So, he basically died of scurvy, which is very sad and a terrible death from what I've heard. But it is not a magical wolf situation.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Okay. That's what I like to hear.
Jason agrees. Jason's all right. Like we had mentioned already, Godfrey was able to confirm the framework of this. She was able to confirm the skeleton of this account. She was able to see that every single person, whether it's Reverend K or Corwin Keeney, everyone in between, they all lived in the area at the time. And that in and of itself, to me, if it doesn't prove the events actually happened, it at least proves, in my opinion, the earliness of this legend itself. Most likely, I would say, is that if you're going to be able to credibly name an entire family, a medical doctor, a reverend, and a weird newcomer to town, and have all of these be real people who existed, you're probably formulating this story.
Sounds like a sweet D&D campaign group.
It does, doesn't it?
The stranger.
You're probably formulating this story within about a generation of it actually taking place.
Yeah.
Or, quote unquote, taking place and these people living there, which is actually very good because after the exorcism works, after the demon, the spirit dog, is exorcised from the village, there's no mention of it for another 30 years. Everything is quiet for three decades. And then we have another story that pops up. So we'll be getting into that story here. But to me, it almost seems as though probably something happened in 1925, and then that thing that happened in 1925, people started to look for answers, and when looking for answers, somebody found the story. It's either true or it's not, but that's probably when it started being widely spread, widely developed. I don't have anything to base this on other than...
Do you think it could be possible the kind of telling of stories between like grandparents or grandchildren as well?
Sure, sure. I think it's absolutely possible. I think that is the primary way that this variation of the legend exists to this day. And so that is why that's probably how it started as well.
Because usually like the kids are like, oh, whatever, dad.
But yeah.
The grandkids are enthralled by it.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, I really do think it's what happens in 1925 that cements it, that starts the story either being told or being spread widely. Maybe there were a few people who were alive at the time who still had it, if it actually did happen that way, or maybe they just pieced everything together at that point. But this, to me, is the interpretive key as to why they thought it was something more than just a wolf. Okay, so the next stage of the Witchy Wolf saga comes to us in, like I said, 1925, 30 years after the story of Corwin Keeney, who was buried in 1895. And there had been neither hide nor hair seen of the spirit wolf since. And then it was back in a real big sort of way. Now, according to Godfrey, she was able to track down an article. The article itself has a self-referential dating of September 3rd, 1925.
Sweet.
This is just 68 years and 19 days before I was born. Coincidence? I don't think so. But we'll talk about that on my 68th birthday. In the meantime, the article is titled Omer, Michigan Search Continues for Missing Boys, and it relates a truly bizarre story. It plays on a few motifs of urban legend, the most obvious being that of the Lover's Lane Massacre. We all know the story. It's prominent in a lot of the things that we've actually talked about, and not alone, is there's some young kids
In an isolated area.
And then everything goes wrong. And suddenly there's a demon.
Yeah.
Or a Mothman.
Something of danger.
Something of danger.
That is not within their normal realm
of this world.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, the story goes that Clive Robertson Jr. and Stuart McClavey, 17 and 16-year-olds respectively, were with their girlfriends Lottie Pastrue and Betty Will as the sun set in the area of the Omer Plains.
Ooh.
They were, of course, doing as young lovers do. As the moon rose overhead, all four of them began to hear a very disconcerting sound.
Was it a full moon?
I don't know. We can check. All right, I'll let you look it up. I'm going to have
third, 19...
25.
It was a full moon. Visible 100%.
That's pretty wild. Now, granted, the article is published that day. It's most likely that it would have taken place at least a day before, or maybe 2 or 3 days before. But in any case, if it wasn't full, it was getting full when it happened.
It wasn't at its full power yet. Yikes. Yikes.
Yikes.
Would have been scarier.
So, they start to hear this sound. It sounded like a kitten mewing in the trees. And then it became augmented by the sound of a woman crying out for help. The young men, as young men are wont to do, leapt up at the sound of danger, hoping to prove themselves heroic to the young ladies.
Nah, dude, just start the car.
Courting.
Just leave.
This happened before so many, like, events. This could be the very, if this is true, this could be, like, the very
the
first time
this
happened.
Trope.
It's entirely possible. They say, we're going to do it. We're gonna find what's going on. You stay here, Betty. I'll do it. And then Betty's like, oh, but Stuart, no.
This is the before credits scene of every Supernatural episode.
Exactly. Now, at this point, it's worth noting, all four of them are actually out of the car. Okay? They're like on a blanket under the moon. The boys leap up and they start approaching the source of the sound and they see an old woman. Like I had said, it was the sound of a kitten mewing out of the trees and then the screaming of an old woman. So they find the old woman and she looks at them and she says...
What is she doing up there?
Well, she's on the ground. She's not up in the tree.
No. I just mean like up there.
Oh.
On Lover's Lane.
Yeah. Who knows? She looks at the boys and you would normally think that the old woman would then say... Oh, my cat. Oh, my dear Whiskers. He's trapped up there with the tree. He'll never come down. I've lost him. That's what I assume old women say.
This is why you don't get a dog.
When their cats go in trees. That's not what happened. That's not what this woman said. She turned around.
I'm going to eat your flesh.
Screaming. As she screamed and as she turned, they described it as though the screaming reverberated and filled the area and started just painting the area sonically. It was just reverberating and echoing from one side of the clearing to the other, to the other, to the other, back, creating a sonic scream chamber. And when that happened, the face of the woman turned into the face of a wolf. At that point, the young women were freaked. The young men were also freaked, it should be said. And just like in 1895, wolves just came out of nowhere. An entire pack of wolves filled the area. And when the girls saw that, they said, well, sorry. And they got to the car and they stayed just long enough to see the two boys dragged off into the woods. They started the car. They went directly to the police station where they reported this. And then a huge search took place. The search revealed nothing. Pretty much nothing. There was scraps of fabric in the area, but the girls couldn't say whether those were or were not the scraps of fabric of the shirts or the pants of the boys.
I feel like you'd be able to tell.
I would think so too.
You know?
But if they saw what they said they saw... I'm not going to fault them. because I would go insane and lose my mind. So
that's also very fair.
They are under a lot of stress. Now, supposedly no bodies were ever found, but in 1975, 50 years later, a belt buckle was discovered in the relative area that was engraved with the initials of Stephen McClavey. And it looked as though it had been out there for some time.
Oh, dear.
Now, you would think this is a relatively easy story to either confirm or deny.
Yes, I would.
But alas.
Ah.
The way...
Of course not.
The way these things shake out usually prevents such an open and shut case. See, the articles had been provided to Godfrey by the Arianac, that's the name of the county, the Arianac County Historical Society.
Okay.
Those people produced these articles. She wasn't able to verify where they came from. She obviously was under the impression that they were authentic enough to include in the book. In any case, when she went to get a good little bit of confirmation of this, when she went to cross-reference it with the articles and the archives of the newspaper of the town at the time, she learned that A, their files had not been digitized yet, even though she was writing this book in like 2017, and B, a substantial amount of those archives had actually been destroyed in a fire back in, I don't know if it said exactly when, but it was like around the turn of the century. So it is impossible
Wait,
to say.
Wait, turn of which century?
Oh, sorry, the 20th okay. or the 21st. Around the year 2000.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's impossible to say if these articles were authentic.
Yeah.
And if they actually came from a real publication or where they came from, what they meant, anything like that. But once again, she was able to find, at the very least, the external verification that such people by these names did exist in the area at the time. And to me, even if the entire account did not take place the way that these articles said it did, I think that the idea of two young missing boys who somehow went in the same relative area as the Omer Plain Cemetery went missing and were never found again, to me, that's a pretty good reason to look back at Corwin Keeney and the mysterious she-wolf that was inhabiting his grave.
So why did it go dormant for 50
years? Because the exorcism worked. Yeah. Exorcisms work all the time, man.
Okay. All right. So then why was 30 years the important bit?
I don't know.
Did the Reverend die by then?
Probably.
Is that what it was?
Probably. Reverends are always old. That's not true at all. I follow a lot of reverends on Twitter.
Just this really old reverend. How old are you? I'm 27.
27 years of age.
Wow.
The good Lord will call me home soon. No, I don't know why the passage of time. Now, I will say 1925 is kind of a weird time to make this specific argument, but it does seem as though the stories of the witchy wolves in general seem to respond to tragedy. So I saw one report, it was either in Godfrey's book or in a different source I was following up on, that said that the stories of the witchy wolves usually come back into vogue around the time of the ends of wars. So after World War I, after World War II, after Vietnam, for some reason these stories seem to come back up.
I mean, that's similar to what we see with spiritualism in general.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly.
So having a supernatural wolf also come back around the same period of time makes sense.
Exactly. So that to me is why maybe 1925, it's definitely not right at the end of World War II by any, or World War I by any means,
no.
But it is still within the time where the world is an unsettled place. You're still reeling from losing so many young men in the Great War, and you are on a track headed to the next great war, that I could see something like this emerge out of the psyche of the people. So what do you think about that story, Jason? We're not done yet, not by a long shot, but that's to me a very interesting story. I just want to get your take on it. What do you think about it?
It feels, again, very much like this perfect setup to where you can say, hey, two kids got lost in the forest and were never found, or you could say, hey, they got eaten by a pack of spectral wolves or something. Like, yeah. That's an easy way out. And also, again, like, having this boogeyman-esque character in the woods is generally a good idea for keeping the townsfolk safe.
True, true. And really, what we see happen is the witchy wolves seem to go quiet again after this attack.
Their hunger has been
sated. Yes. Now, there is some just hearsay. I wasn't able to find any actual reports that after World War II, the wolves kind of mounted up again and people saw them and interacted with them. But really, where we see it come into vogue and then stay into vogue with the population of Omer and Greater Michigan is in the late 1960s and the early 70s. It's around that time that an author by the name of David A. Kulczyk, he grew up about 20 miles south of Omer Plains. He wrote multiple books. Most of them were like true crime themed and stuff like that. And in one of his magazine articles, he actually recounted a very strange experience he had in the Omer Plains as a young man. Now, he went to the Omer Plains twice. And both times, he was piled in a car with like-minded teenage boys who had something to prove. Because by this point, in the late 60s, early 70s, Omer Plains had become synonymous with the Witchy Wolves. It became that part of a town, that place that you go in your state that is very haunted or that is very scary and you go to prove yourself or to find out the truth. Right. Here, we don't have something that's a one-to-one correlation. The best we have in Boise, I would say, is the Old Pen, where you can go to the Old Pen.
And yeah, it's a rite haunted. Of passage.
But in like Wisconsin, for instance, there's a street called like Boy Scout Lane. And Boy Scout Lane is apparently, and it's a real street, but it's apparently where there was a tribe of Boy Scouts who were found murdered. And there, you know, that sort of a thing. And one of our old coworkers actually grew up right down the street from Boy Scout Lane and not said nothing weird ever happened there. But it's in the mythos. It's in the story. And that's where David was in the late 60s when he went packed in this car with these other teenage boys.
And the story became true. Oh no, did I spoil it?
Depends on what you mean. And your criterion for truth, which is up to each individual, I would say. Now, both times he went, no one was brave enough to get out of the car, but both times he personally heard what he described as a, quote, hideous, high-pitched laughing bark that came from all directions out of the near total darkness, unquote. For those who were brave enough to venture out of the car, they would not infrequently find themselves thrown to the ground with a great weight on their chest and the sound of, quote, snarling and snapping at the victim's head, unquote. Now, Kulczyk claimed that these experiences, they changed people. The skeptical or the too big for their britches would go into the woods and different people would come out. Gentler people. Quieter people, more reserved people. It had a real effect on the people who were brave enough to face it head on. Now, Kulczyk also claimed to have seen with his own eyes cars that were scratched and dented on coming out of the woods that theoretically had not been so when they went into the woods.
It's really interesting how these wolves have gone from being a physical presence to an audio presence, primarily.
Yeah. Yeah, and not even necessarily just audible. It is audible, most likely, and the thing about it is, as we'll actually talk about in a little bit, the audible phenomena is pretty well attested, not only just with David Kulczyk, but with other
research groups. Well, I mean, if we're talking about the kids again.
Yeah.
Like, really, nothing crazy happened until that woman had that crazy, like, sonic attack at
Exactly. them. Exactly. Exactly, but they go from being just a normal wolf in a weird place at a weird time to being supernatural.
Yes.
First, you've got a normal wolf, then you've got a shapeshifter, now you've got a full-blown spirit demon wolf thing that you're fighting against. Now, another story from another perspective comes from an individual named Lindsay Russell, and she lived in the Omer Plains area around the same time that Kulczyk would have made his trips there. Mm-hmm. She grew up very close to the area of the Witchy Wolves and was told about the story by her father, but she never believed it until she had her own experiences with them. Now, the biggest thing that ever happened, and I think it may have happened multiple times, but there was one day, the first time it happened, that was just, it burned into her memory. She was an elementary school child, so she was young. There's all sorts of ways to discredit it, if we want to discredit it, but what she claims is that she was out back of her house when she saw a line of canine-like creatures moving in a pack across a distant ridgeline. Now, the ridgeline itself was a constant companion in Lindsay's life. She had grown up in the shadow of it all of her days, and while it was a little ways away, she could tell that something was wrong, and that the shape she saw that day seemed impossibly large. And not only did they seem too big, they also seemed too flat. They looked to her to not be three-dimensional objects, but rather just shadows. Now, as a quick aside, this very bizarre idea of walking wolf shadows.
We've talked about Watchers in the past.
We've talked about the Watchers, that's true. But specifically,
canine shadows?
Is one account, and we may have mentioned it in one of our episodes about Godfrey or the bonus episode we did about Monsters Among Us back when it came out. But there is a story in her book, Monsters Among Us, that has to do with the Brunswick wolf shadow. Now, the story was related to Linda Godfrey by a woman named Julie, and it was transmitted to her by her stepfather, and then many years later confirmed by her aunt. The story goes that when the entire family was gathered together on one warm summer day in 1969, they gazed out of the window into the garden and saw what could only be described as the shadow of a wolf. But it was a bipedal creature. It was walking on its hind legs. They actually saw this shadow turn, and when it did, just like a two-dimensional object, it actually disappeared for a moment and then reappeared looking the other way. It became aware of the family of six who were watching it and screaming their heads off from inside, and then it turned around again and ran off into the woods. Julie's aunt remembered feeling a pure evil radiating from the creature. And there was a violent assault on a woman that very same evening on the first road over beyond the woods that it had run into. They estimated it at about 7 foot tall, and it was head and shoulder above their corn plants that they had out in their garden. Now that's an account, like I said, it's in Godfrey's second newest book, her last book, Monsters Among Us. It is in Brunswick, New Jersey, so it is not close. Anywhere it's not near, in the yeah. area.
It's that's really interesting, though. I wish there's a little bit more detail on whether or not it was an actual shadow, like the shape curved on whatever object it was on, or if it was like something that was like Vantablack, where it was just literally any contours whatsoever because it absorbed like all the light.
I think it was more the Vantablack than anything else, because they talked about it walking through, and they talked about it looking solid, and yet looking two-dimensional.
It sounded like it was its own object, not being projected onto another object.
Exactly. So that's what I would assume. And that is also what Lindsay Russell, in her story, she claims
the pack on the ridge, right?
Pack on the ridgeline. And they are headed into the area that she claims, the area where the majority of these witchy wolf sightings happen.
To be completely honest, shapes at a distance tend to look more two-dimensional and darker in appearance anyway. So that part doesn't really surprise me whatsoever. How she describes their height, though, is the interesting part. And that's where the being open for interpretation is probably a little bit more open.
And like I had mentioned, this was actually during the time that the wolves were still functionally extinct in the area. Remember, so they went out. I want to say it was actually around the time of 1925. It may have been a little later that the wolves were declared non-existent in Michigan.
Well, there's a couple different layers of like extinct.
Right.
There's extinct to where there are literally no individuals of that population left in the wild. There's also pretty much extinct to where there's not a population large enough to sustain an ongoing presence. So within a few generations, they're going to be gone anyway. So there's several different like extinct clarifications to really talk about. My assumption is it's the second type of extinct where there's not a population large enough. I'd be awestruck to believe that hunters literally got to every wolf.
That's fair.
Before the population was able to have a new generation.
The dates here, especially smack dab in the middle of the 50s and 60s, would preclude widespread wolf activity. But like Jason said, it's entirely possible that the numbers themselves were simply negligible, as opposed to being actually there were no wolves in the area. However, the thing about Lindsay Russell's story is that she really didn't think too much of it. Well, she thought of it.
She was a child.
Like, oh, and animals. Yeah, animals. And then even as she grew up, she said, okay, that was a little weird, but I'm probably just remembering it wrong.
Right.
However, 15 years later...
Did she get a second source to confirm?
Yeah, so 15 years later, she was actually on a long drive with a boyfriend of hers who lived in the same area, grew up in the same area she did, who did report seeing the exact same thing on the same ridgeline. I don't know what his perspective was, but he as well had this idea, kind of like you had said, of the Vanta Black, the just two-dimensional, absorbing all light wolf. So... again, by no means does it prove anything,
right.
But it is an interesting idea, at least, that there are people seeing things that don't belong there. Now, to me, what almost, like I was saying at the very beginning of this, what I really like about the Witchy Wolves and the legend in general is that it forks. There are two different...
Yeah, because now we're gone completely different areas. We went from an audio phenomena...
Yep.
To a visual one now.
And exactly.
But still kind of a lack of visual.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And even that, we have two different supposed origin stories. The first origin story, which we've been focusing on, is that of Corwin Keeney in the Civil War.
Right.
An evil magic brought up from the South. However...
Cursed bones.
The story that most children are told...
How prevalent are wolves in the South?
I have not a clue.
Right? Like, that's the thing that I keep getting tripped up on, is if it is cursed from someone local to, like, New Orleans or Louisiana in general. When I think of those places, I think of big cats.
Yeah, true.
I think about alligators. I don't really think wolves. Packs.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting, to say the least.
It is. But the story that most people are raised with, that most people grow up with, that informs the phenomena of the Witchy Wolf, is not actually the Corwin Keeney story. In fact, they're not raised with any story at all. They're raised with a summary explanation of the phenomena. And the summary explanation is this, that the Chippewa people, the First Nations people who inhabit the area, that they have in their burial rites, their funeral practices, and their local belief, the belief of a spirit guardian that watches over the graves of fallen Chippewa warriors. That's what most people are told when they're looking at the Witchy Wolf phenomena or when kids are growing up. That's what the boogeyman in the wolf is, or the boogeyman in the woods is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily this weird 1925 story of these kids going missing. It's not this 1895 story of the weird wolf. It's this Native American spiritual tradition. And to me, that's bizarre. I don't understand how we can have two completely different origin stories for the same phenomena. Again, one of them...
So I think what it comes down to is a melting point and also misconceptions at the same time.
Well, and we'll be talking about, as you say, like a melting point and misconceptions. We'll be talking about that in just a moment.
My bad.
Yeah. No, we'll be talking about that in a moment as well. But I want to tell you the story.
You put that bottle down, Sam. Don't you point it at me.
I want to tell you the story, as best as we have a story, from the Chippewa people. And why I think that this specific idea of a spirit tradition of guardianship over graves is particularly prevalent and almost fits into what I've learned about this tribe. And then we'll talk about why everybody's saying what they're saying about these things.
All right.
But there is obviously a good amount of stereotypes at play in such an assertion that the strange howling noises and bizarre canine phenomena that individuals experience in the woods are linked to Native American spirit wolves. Obviously.
Okay.
We don't need to rehash that. But it is worth noting to me that of the, especially Native people of the area, the Chippewa themselves do have a very special connection with the wolf. In the Chippewa creation story, a great and powerful spirit named Wenebojo, and I'm sorry for everything I pronounce, Wenebojo, he came across a group of wolves. He was out wandering. He finds these wolves who at first he addresses as his nephews, but who over the course of time become much closer than that to Wenebojo. They hunted for him, and they would bring him back deer and elk and moose, which he would then cook for himself, as well as the tribe of wolves. One of the younger wolves even noticed that the loneliness of Wenebojo was so great that this solitary spirit wandered the earth alone, and that that had affected him on a very primal level, that he decided and he vowed that even though he was the best hunter of the tribe and that was what he loved to do, that he was going to stay behind and he was going to keep Wenebojo company and give him companionship for all of his days. This wolf, Wenebojo specifically called his brother. However, their close bond evoked the ire of the wicked Manadog spirits, who resolved to destroy Wenebojo's brother. They were successful, and Brother Wolf was indeed destroyed. Wenebojo then visited the island upstream from his and the other wolves' homes, where the chief of the river demons, named Manado, was known to sun himself on bright days. Finding him there, he used the claw of a kingfisher as his arrow and pierced the Manado's heart, pierced the Manado's shadow, thereby piercing his soul and destroying him forever. Because of Manado's close relation with the water, Wenebojo's revenge started a chain reaction which ended with the flooding of the entire world. Wenebojo then climbed the highest pine tree he could, and as the waters rose, they only stopped when they reached right underneath his nose. And from there, the creatures of the earth dived to the bottom of the flooded world and brought up dirt, handful by handful, in order to fashion a new land. Now, Wenebojo's brother, the wolf, was known as Chibiabos, and he did not return after the flood. Now, however, he serves as the guardian of the dead and the lord of the underworld. He accompanies the dead on their four-day journey into the next world, and once there, he rules as a just and fair lord who shows kindness to all he oversees. I'm not even going to try the Chippewa words for what they call this afterlife, because they are very complex, and I do not want to butcher anything more than I have to. But basically, it translates to the land of eternal happiness, the land of eternal goodness. It's a very positive afterlife in this belief system. Now, when we look at this idea that these beings are somehow connected with the spirit world, it's not the most far-fetched thing to say that they do have connections to the native traditions of the area.
And on that, I did do a little bit of background research myself, because this did spark a bit of interest me. It tends to be that Native American tribes, First Nations tribes, do have this deep spiritual kinship with wolves. Some origin stories of their own creation beliefs involve actually a wolf bringing them to life, and also just this set of reverence for wolves, because they are also a pack animal, mm-hmm. just like we are, essentially, with our tribes, and also skilled hunters. Many of them were the center of prayers before going out and hunting. And one tribe close to this region, their word for their tribe was also the same word that they used for wolf.
Oh, wow.
So I don't recall.
That's okay.
I breezed through quite a bit of information, but there is a very deep connection and reverence to wolves from the peoples of this area.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really, really not overreaching to say that the wolf is actually sacred, especially in Chippewa culture itself, because every piece of reservation land that is controlled by that tribe actually has very, very stringent bans on any sort of wolf abuse, wolf hunting, wolf trapping, anything.
Yeah, like I said, and like that story just showed mm-hmm. is that they are wolves are very much their spiritual kin.
Exactly. The tribe itself has also been long associated with activism, social and political activism regarding the outlawing of wolf killing outside of their jurisdiction as well, because of this kinship, this connection that they feel. The wolf is the brother to the Chippewa people, and they already lost their brother once to the wicked powers that be. According to the legend that it seems most of the youth were taught, it's this identification with native lore that is used as an explanation for the witchy wolves. But what is the official reason that it is primarily the Omer Plains that is a hotbed of activity? The witchy wolves are claimed to protect the graves of the dead, honorable warriors of the Chippewa tribe. Each grave has its own guardian, and anyone getting close to the final resting place of one of these fallen heroes, either intentionally or not, finds themselves liable to a gruesome retaliation by the spirit guardians. This is particularly important, in my opinion, believable, due to a little bit of what I've learned, not only about Chippewa funeral rituals and traditions, but also some of the just terrible things that have happened to this tribe in this area over time. Now, as we mentioned a moment ago, Chibiabos is often thought of as accompanying the dead on their four-day journey to the afterlife. Now, just like with the pharaohs and the Greeks of old, getting to the final resting place does not happen at death. It's actually quite a journey. And in the Chippewa tradition, it often requires some additional material assistance. So you would often have offerings of tobacco that were made. You would have quality deerskin moccasins that were used to shod the feet of the deceased, which is a tradition that remains to this day. I actually even saw in an article, it was actually really cool. It was an article just about Chippewa burial traditions in general, and there was a spiritual leader of the people who made an offhanded comment that says, yes, we still bury our dead with moccasins on. If we buried them with Nikes on, who's going to follow those tracks? It was pretty awesome.
That's pretty good.
So you have, at the very least, some very, very desirable physical possessions that are being buried with them, as well as the idea is that any time during the 4 days that they're making this journey, they can actually appear to their relatives, their kin, in dreams, and request other specific material as well, which can very well lead to a kind of targeting, I would say, of grave robbing.
Well, I mean, targeting grave robbing is kind of, again, a tradition for
a certain class of people that we both belong to.
Yep.
So it is. It's something that has happened for a good amount of American history.
American, unfortunately, Egyptian, probably Mesopotamian.
Right. I'm speaking specifically about white people robbing the graves of Native Americans as a sort of sick archaeological expedition.
Well, when you can't colonize new lands.
You know, you just got to.
Yeah.
This even, okay, the location itself is a little bit away from the Omer Plains. It's in Sault Ste. Marie. It's in the same general Great Lakes area. And in 1826, there was a veritable crisis of grave robbing taking place among the Chippewa people that was being carried out by enlisted individuals in the army, in the American army stationed in the area, taking the skulls and sometimes the full-blown skeletons of the buried Chippewa people, as well as anything else that they found in the graves.
Gosh. I mean, thankfully, these practices don't remain anymore. Archaeology has gotten a lot more.
Jason, you're so studious. Wrong. You don't even know.
Oh no.
Oh my God. We're going to talk about it. We'll talk about it
to an extent.
To an extent. They still, yes, they're not as bad. They're not as bad. They do still happen.
I mean, yes, archaeological sites are still ridden with human bones.
We'll talk about
it. Hopefully.
We'll talk about it. Anyway, so there's this letter written in 1826. It's written by the agent assigned by the government to the Lake Superior Chippewa people, and it's addressed to his superior, the governor of the Michigan Territory and superintendent of Indian Affairs for the Upper Great Lakes area.
That is a title.
It's a title, and that is the exact title, and I use the exact words of the title, even if I think the words are bull, but that's fine. So, this letter paints a heart-wrenching scene. I'm going to just go ahead and quote from it for a minute. Quote, "Great excitement prevails among the Indians, and they are now beating their drums and uttering their lamentations mixed with the execrations upon the perpetrators of this atrocious crime. I attended the opening of the rifled graves this morning. The chiefs commenced by asking the spirits of the relations, by addressing the spirits of their relations and asking for forgiveness for the acts that they were about to commit. Then they commenced removing the earth. They found the coffin of the first grave split open and the body taken therefrom. The lid of the other grave examined by them was cut off, about 14 inches from the top, as only the head was taken. This separation, as is reported, was effected by a sharpened spade and the loathsome trophy conveyed away." Unquote. Such disgraceful practices, while no longer state-sponsored and carried out by otherwise respectable institutions, such as universities and museums, are still in practice today. In 2014, the FBI were invited to take a look at a museum, at the artifacts in a museum of a recently dead museum curator, just because it had a whole lot of different artifacts that, shall we say, were maybe not supposed to be there, and people were concerned about how they got there. And when they did this, to everyone's shock and horror, they uncovered a treasure trove of over 2,000 native bones comprising 500 individuals, almost all of which were stolen recently from burial plots. So
that's actual grave robbing, though.
That is legitimate grave robbing.
Yeah, I meant like archaeologists as a studious.
Yes. Group. Yeah.
You know.
True. They're trying. They're
grave robbing.
They're
and
doing
modern
science
archaeology
as best as they can. Yeah.
I mean, it's more like archaeology like forensics now.
Yeah. Yeah, but even then, back in the day, it was the legitimate archaeologists who were doing this too. It wasn't just grave robbing.
I mean, it was straight up Indiana Jones style.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool stuff in the tomb, it's mine now.
Yeah, cool bones in the tomb, they're mine now.
My students will love this.
Yeah, exactly. That was the idea. And so, like, really the only problem with what was happening to the Chippewa people in the eyes of the government is that it wasn't a state-sponsored institution. It was not a museum that was doing this. It was just drunk army cadets who were like, I'm going to steal this guy's head. And do you know why they did that? For racist pseudoscience purposes.
I was going to say, because they're white.
Well, yes, but specifically, the reason that it was usually actually skulls more than full skeletons that were stolen, other than the ease of it, was their use in phrenology, which is the racist pseudoscience which claims that elements like skull size and formation, as well as any anomalies, could be used to discover what the intelligence of a person was, what their disposition would be, and what, if any, their mental talents would be. This was then used to reinforce and validate the oppression of non-Caucasian minorities because, as any good scientist would do, they used their own group as the not only the baseline of normalcy, but while being the baseline of normalcy, the Caucasian skulls were the ones that also exhibited the traits that would be the most synonymous with high intellectual functioning and good disposition.
Naturally.
Naturally.
I tend to think about this kind of stuff every time like some ancient alien expert talks about elongated skulls that get found.
Yep.
I'm like, do you realize that that's just a trend in human society to do that?
That's
on occasion,
what
like
they did.
Like, as a tribal group, that happens frequently. It's not an alien skull. It's just skulls are easily malleable when you're born.
Yeah. Yeah. And you stick a board to it.
Yeah. Or rings or all kinds
of
stuff.
But again, the other thing of it there is, what? And this is not me saying this. This is the ancient astronaut who lives in my heart saying this. Mm-hmm. The ancient astronaut theorist. Why would they do that if not because they were emulating
their gods? Sam, why do we get piercings and tattoos? Who are the aliens? Why do we grow beards? Why it's all cultural referencing.
That's a good question. I like it.
I don't specifically know where beard growing became fashionable and a thing besides for 2010.
The Gallic people.
Okay. One Gallic group
tribes that Caesar tried figured to conquer.
Out, like, oh, beards. This is how we beat Caesar.
We're into it.
Yeah, okay. And that's what I'm getting at. Yeah. Is that like you're talking about you're trying to figure out where a cultural reference is taking place and how it became such a thing, and yeah. That's tough to do when you don't have physical evidence or written record of that like trend setting.
Yeah.
You don't have that.
I agree. Now, as much as I wish it was otherwise, despite all of the very good reasons, in my opinion, for there to be the need of a burial guardian and for that burial guardian to be a wolf in the Chippewa society, in the Chippewa tradition, there's actually no legend specifically regarding a ghostly spiritual wolf guarding the burial sites of any Chippewa dead, much less their noble fallen warriors. Now, this is by no means to say it is not true. As often happens in cases where people go talking to First Nations people asking about their beliefs, they aren't always necessarily happy to have them recorded and written down and archived by people outside of their society. So it's entirely possible that legend exists. I did find a whole lot of different tradition and different myth, none of which had that specific spirit guardian of a grave component to it. So,
which that just seems like an embellishment.
Yes.
There are always the wicked wolves, like Red Riding Hood or evil wolf creatures that are lurking around at night in places that you shouldn't be.
Right. That's true. Now,
and it was probably beneficial to spread that kind of rumor so that grave robbing wasn't happening.
Exactly. Really, truly.
If anything, it's probably just a newer adaptation in order to do that kind of preventative work.
To keep it going. Now, it is, though, even if it doesn't have its a solid basis, a literary basis or a recorded basis that we can see, it is still a very well-attested idea. It is one that many people in the area are familiar with. Anybody with an idea and a passion for the paranormal, or any young people who want to go out into the woods and prove themselves, they're all familiar with this idea. It's so popular, in fact, that at least one group of paranormal investigators personally rolled up to the Omer Plains in order to examine it for any kind of spirit activity in general. Now, in their report, they said that they did leave quite satisfied. However, I don't know why when I read the reports of their report, because I cannot read their actual report, which is weird in and of itself. Basically, what's happening here is there's a group called the Erie Temperance Entertainment, or ETE for short. It is an entertainment group.
Okay.
So keep that in mind.
Like the WWE?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
They said they were happy with the results, which included seeing white orbs flying around. Cool. Okay, all right, there's that. But then the only other part of this phenomena that they actually verified, I would say, is the sounds. This weird sound is attested to by most people who live in the area. There are many different explanations for this sound other than ghost wolves, but it is a fun explanation. The only other thing that they uncovered that is actually, in my opinion, quite unrelated, but still possibly adjacent to the witchy wolf phenomena, is that there were two different individuals, I believe they were unrelated, who did not know each other, that told the same story of coming around a curve in a road that then led to a straightaway. And as they came around the curve, they saw a man dressed in white, glowing, sitting in a rocking chair by the side of the road. So that sounds like a ghost to me. And I'm okay with that. It does not have a lot to do with the witchy wolves, anything at all. But what's weird is this ETE, I can only find reference to them in articles about the Witchy Wolves. They do not have a Facebook page. They've never had a Facebook page. The reference was in 2009, so I'd assume that they probably should have had a Facebook page. They were supposedly part of another group called Michigan Paranormal Entertainment, I think, or something like that, MPE. That group may exist, but even then I'm not sure. Basically, I can't find anything about these people, but the idea was that they were happy with their results, and so they were going to take their results and use them to create kind of like a promo that they were going to pitch to the network, and then when the network said, yes, we'll buy a special based on this, then they were going to come back and do a full-scale investigation. That never happened, and so this story just dies in 2009. There's nothing else that I can find about it.
That's probably for the best.
I would have just liked, and that's the thing, is A, I would have liked to see their reports, but B, I really hate to say it, but if you're an entertainment group,
you're
not going to trust
things.
Your reports.
Yeah, you're doing it for the entertainment aspect of
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And kudos to them, because they told Aranac Independent was the only newspaper where I found any mention of these people. And then Godfrey then references those articles in her book. They were completely straight up and were like, yeah, we're going to try to sell a show about this. So at least there's that. I don't know if they were completely honest and straightforward with people when they were actually doing the interviewing, or if they kind of made it sound like they were really just in it to get to the truth.
Right.
But who knows at the end of the day. Now, there is one last very, very, very compelling story that Godfrey mentions in her book, which takes place within an hour or so of Omer, that in my opinion is very related to the Witchy Wolves.
Okay.
It has to do with an off-duty police officer who is going hunting at a gunnery range near Oscoda, which is a township about an hour away from Omer. And remember, the plains are about 20 minutes or 20 miles, I want to say, north of Omer. And then this gunnery range is actually, I think, like 10 miles southeast of Oscoda. So in reality, we're actually in about a 30-mile radius of the plains itself.
Okay.
Where this would happen, theoretically. The range was in a wooded area, just like the plains. And the officer claimed to hear some very loud, unsettling rustling coming from behind him. He kept looking around, but was unable to find anything that could be making the noise. He even had a rifle in his hands, and yet felt like he needed to leave. Even with a gun cocked and ready to go, he was like, I don't want to come up against whatever's making this sound. So he does. He starts to leave. He's walking out on the same track he walked in on. And as he did, the sound seemed to follow him. Now, he quickly ducked into some bushes in order to try to draw out whatever it was, and he did exactly that. What he described was something that he could neither believe nor understand. It looked to him like a shimmering in the air, an amorphous form, which looked like a, in his words, cloaked predator. Like from
Predator. Like the actual movie animal.
Now, not necessarily it didn't really have a form. It didn't really have a shape. He's just talking about the visual quality of the air.
So the air is bouncing light somehow.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the man actually shot at the thing, which I admire the hell out of.
Sure.
That he's like, I'm going in blazing. He shot at it with both his rifle and his 357 Magnum handgun. And was sure that he could not have missed, and yet the thing didn't move. It just stayed there, waiting. As he began moving, he noticed that it actually changed appearance. He described it as something kind of akin to a holographic card image, where it changes based on the angle that you're looking at. At one angle, it was entirely invisible, and only the woods could be seen. As you moved, it shimmers like Predator. And then on the other side, stopped, looking at it, he saw just a black hole, as if there was just a bit of nothingness in the middle of the woods. This happened in daylight. Needless to say, he left as quickly and quietly as he could. And that's the last story of anything that I could find related to the Witchy Wolf. Now, if you'll remember, it does necessarily have to link back to Skinwalker Ranch. We have another very, very similar report. It's more violent, it's more pronounced, but another idea of like the cloaked predator kind of visual effect.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of how to pull that off.
Yeah.
And
because if it was just shimmery, it's almost like it would almost be like one of those. I don't know if you remember them. I don't know if any progress is being made with them, but those crappy invisibility cloaks that we were all promised. Do you remember those?
So
where they basically just like bend light around. It's still completely obvious that something is there because it's like really distorted, but you are technically seeing around the cloak.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Those. When you said that, I thought you meant like a projector style thing.
No.
Because that's like the most reasonable, weirdly enough, way of going invisible. It's just projecting what's behind you on you.
Yeah.
I was thinking like, if anything, it's kind of like a mirage.
Yes.
Where you have a weird flux of warm air and cold air creating some of a shimmering effect in front of you. But again, it's... If you're in a range, you shouldn't be having that warm air rising effect because it's not like, you know, a road on a hot summer day.
Exactly.
You're in a wooded area where essentially your climate should be fairly much stable.
And with a mirage, as you go around the backside of it, it does not become a black hole.
And then we've got the idea of something that could be like Vanta black again, where no light really shines back at you. It's really, really weird. It's almost like as if he was right on it when he was talking about one of those holographic cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Because those are, he describes it perfectly. You have to be standing looking at him in a specific angle to see an image or to not see anything at all. So it's a pretty wild encounter.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. And like I said, the only other thing close to it, it actually leverages the like I said, the Vanta Black, the solid shadow idea, and that Skinwalker Ranch experience. And as much as I hate to bring back up Skinwalker Ranch, because it's going to make me go insane one day, I mean, if that... And let's just get something straight. For as much of the research I've done that I've become skeptical and this and that, I'm still 100% convinced there's something evil happening at Skinwalker Ranch that's beyond human limitations. Now, if whatever is causing that in Skinwalker Ranch is in more places than one, then it almost seems as though this phenomena that's being recorded in Michigan is too normal. Even if there are shape-shifting wolf peoples,
it's not...
As intense as what's happening at Skinwalker Ranch. I could totally see
this being the same effect that happened with the two-dimensional looking wolf.
Uh-huh.
Because, again, we're going from looking at it one side and seeing an image, and then flipping it to another side and not seeing the image again, and then back and forth. So it'd be interesting if there was some sort of weird cloaking mechanism that did that when you're looking at it perfectly straight on.
Yeah, yeah.
While looking at the side, you get the actual image. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have to be required in order to make it work, having half of it covered in like a Vanta Black situation, paint job, to where it's consuming the light around it.
There you go.
Or getting bounced onto it. I don't know. It's weird. That kind of stuff is wild.
It's completely wild. It's completely insane. And yet, I think that the reason that people... start to lose, and it was actually the question that we received last week about if we were able to prove one existence, does it prove all the existences, sort of thing. If we can prove Bigfoot, does it prove vampires and Loch Ness and whatever? The answer to that is no. I think we both agreed on that. But I think that it's easy to be skeptical when we take things individually, individual accounts. But when we then connect those together to other things, that's where I start to rediscover my belief that there is something bigger going on here, sort of a thing. So that last pin, I'm so glad she included it because she only mentioned it in the book in passing, basically. She gave about a paragraph and a half on it and then talked to the next thing. And I'm so glad she did because it almost reinforces the legitimacy of this for me, with it sharing its identification with such a bizarre phenomena that I've only ever heard happening one other place that is the epicenter of weird activity. But
I think that's that Skinwalker Ranch is the epicenter of weird activity just because of how much misinformation gets shrewd and how much information does not get released.
Yeah.
And how just cryptic and mysterious the place tends to be in general.
True, true.
I think that helps a lot to create this mythos of craziness that happens there.
Yeah, for sure. So the question is, what's going on here, right? And for me, I think, Jason, based on the comment you made a moment ago, I think we actually have, at least in one respect, pretty similar ideas. For me, it's an interesting mix of all of the supposed origins. I think that the story of the Confederate or of the Union soldier is either consciously or unconsciously melted together and mixed with the story of the Spirit Wolf Guardian. And the story of the kids, the missing kids, is melted together with the story of kids going into the woods and coming out changed by some harrowing experience. I think that it's all of these things kind of swirling together. The fact that there is a possible oral tradition regarding Chippewa burial grounds then could be morphed when you have a specific fallen soldier whose burial ground was assaulted by or defended by, depending on your perspective, this ferocious wolf creature.
Yeah, it's a remix.
Exactly. It really does seem like a remix.
What most storytelling is just remixing and reimagining stories from the location or from your own past into bringing new life to it.
Yeah.
So I think it's, and that's why I like it. It's just simply the fact that it is like you have this foundation of local lore and culture, mm-hmm. which America was really good at wiping that away.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still these very specific instances that it still pops up and becomes relevant. Yeah.
Yeah. We tried to cover it and try to, not try to, whatever. We're talking about things hundreds of years on, but at the time people tried to cover it. People tried to
tame it.
To westernize, to modernize these ideas that were their own heritage, their own stories. And they're almost impossible to be completely suppressed. And right. It just erupts in the psyche.
Because even if we're not aware of it, the local customs and culture that exists, we do absorb just mm-hmm. subconsciously.
Yeah.
And that also kind of determines how we expect to perceive things.
Yeah. So for me, the question then is, well, what comes first? Is it the good storytelling and the culture that then creates this phenomena of confirmation? Oh, we've heard the story. We go to the woods. We hear the sounds. Maybe somebody falls over. Maybe there's something else going on. Or is it that there are these things happening that then give birth to the stories? And that, I think, is really... It's an unprovable question.
I think it comes down to a bit of both.
But probably,
when we look at myth in general, we use it as a way to rationalize things that we just don't understand.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit of both, where you have this incredibly old history and culture, and then you've got essentially a contemporary mask over the top of it. It's America, baby.
It's America, baby.
Like, that's what it is. I mean, it is constantly this reimagining of old tales that were long forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And how they seep up and bubble up to the local and the current consciousness.
Yeah, I agree. I, for one, I don't doubt it. I don't disbelieve it. I think that if I was to go to this area, I would at least hear something. I might see something. I might experience something. I think that this is one of those things that by itself is just one weird little story, but when fit into the larger picture of all of the weird little stories, just confirms to me that there is something beyond what I can see and touch right here and now. I really do believe at least the stories that are named specifically David Kulchik and what was her name? Lindsay Russell. I believe that they saw what they saw, that they experienced. And I believe there's probably something weird happening in the woods there that maybe we can't exist. Jason, what do you think?
I think it comes down to a lot of perception. Yeah.
Jason answer.
I mean, it does, but a lot of these things, they're not something that can be easily duplicated or really observed again. And anytime that a human is interacting with data, it becomes biased.
Yeah, true.
It's just is how it happens. I mean, there's the classic perception trick test thing where you have the printout that's a picture of a chessboard that has a cylinder that casts a shadow over the chessboard. And when you look at one of the white squares in the shadow, it looks lighter than one of the black squares that is outside the shadow, even though it's the same exact color. Mm. We expect shadows to be similar, or something that is in a shadow to be similar to its version outside the shadow. We actively do this to everything because of how often we're interacting with shadows. That's actually one of the big issues with like visual effect artists too, is that they have to account for a whole lot more light that is obvious to us when we're experiencing something, but isn't necessarily obvious when trying to create like a CGI thing. Mm. And that's something that has to be put in. Otherwise it snaps the illusion.
Yeah. Yeah, it brings you back out of the immersion.
We perceive in our perception certain things, and we can get psyched out quite easily. And I think essentially what happens is that you get this mask of, again, local culture, local custom, the area in general, and just your previous experiences in the world to kind of filter what you expect to see. And then your mind creates that with what information it's given.
All right.
Which is generally most sightings for me, especially if you're in a wilderness place, even if it's something that you are constantly at, if it's your own backyard kind of activity stuff. That's pretty common.
All right.
I think it is phenomenally cool, though.
Oh, it's a really great story.
And I'm a little
really
upset that there was no wolves making potions.
That would be something else.
I was thinking we would have dogmen making potions.
And maybe we can find something like that. I don't particularly want to.
But they be witchy wolves.
In any case, we would just like to thank...
It's a graveyard bash?
No. Witchy wolves? No. I hate that.
That was right on. It's perfect.
Okay.
All right.
You're happy with yourself. I want to thank Linda again, Linda Godfrey, for sending us this book.
Absolutely. I also love the cover art.
It's very good.
I'm digging it.
It's very scary. It freaks me out. So in any case, I Know What I Saw, Modern Day Encounters with Monsters of Urban, New Urban Legend and Ancient Lore. That is by Linda Godfrey. And it is coming out. It's published today. Today is the day it was published.
So you can say it's already been published because this
by the time people hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Today.
Dope.
That was good timing on our part. So you can find it wherever books are sold. Support your local bookshops. I Know What I Saw, Modern Day Encounters with Monsters of New Urban Legend and Ancient Lore by Linda S. Godfrey is available now wherever books are sold. You can get it on Kindle. You can get it on the Apple iBook store. You can get it everywhere. So
do it.
We just want to thank Linda again for sending us this excellent book. And I have no doubt that I will be pulling from it. There was actually another subject that we were going to do this week, but I figured if we were talking about Linda Godfrey specifically, I wanted to do wolves. I wanted to do dogs. And we only covered about half of what was in the chapter on the witchy wolves. So don't feel like you know everything about them, because there's even more. So anyway, thank you to Linda. Thank you to Penguin Books as well, who are the publishers on that. Now, before we go, I don't have any announcements. Do you have announcements?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Cool. So we'd just like to thank three people.
Yes.
We'd like to thank Kevin. Woo!
Oh, okay. Kevin. That's what we're
yeah,
doing.
Yeah, sorry. Our new patron.
Let me try it again.
We would like to thank our new patrons. These are people who have gone to patreon.com/analonepodcast and have committed to helping us keep the lights on. This is especially just significant to us. It keeps us going. It lets us afford research materials. It lets us afford to buy lighting rigs and stuff for Jason's jump to video. Jason's jump to video is what I'm going to call this endeavor that we're working on right now. It really supports us in a lot of ways, and we're just really grateful for it. So if you go to if you go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast, you can learn about all the different levels to support us. If you support us at the $5 level, you get access to all of the bonus episodes we've already recorded. And there's some good ones there. They're all good ones. And then you also get access to what you get at the $3 level, which is an earlier unedited version of our episode. So you don't have to wait as long, and you get more stupid jokes and us looking things up and being wrong and then cutting it out of the show. So
that's what we do best.
All sorts of stuff. So again, that's patreon.com/notalonepodcast. We would like to thank Kevin.
All right, Kevin.
We'd like to thank Sydney Morehouse.
Yes, Sydney.
And we'd like to thank Carter McBride.
Okay, yeah, Carter.
Thank you all so much for supporting the show. Now, here's the thing, guys. We've been doing this for 2 years. We're on episode 103. Oh yeah. Man, we hit 2 years a while ago. We didn't even mention it. We're almost
months. It's fine.
Yeah, we're almost 2.5 years now. I thought we all knew the way the game worked here, which is that if you go to iTunes and you leave us a 5-star review and you write us a review, then I will be able to find your name, thank you, and then maybe read your review. We have had multiple people rate us 5 stars, but we have not had anybody in the last 2 weeks actually write a review. So
guys, do you want a shout out or not?
Do you want a shout out or not? I think I have proved over the last 103 episodes that I'll just read whatever.
Almost anything.
Pretty much anything. I don't think I've ever not. So I'm going to go ahead and read what this person says. They are an older review, but whatever. I'm going to read it because who cares? So this is Azur Talon Prime. They say, the conversations I wish I could have. The guys sound like me and my friends having late night talks. At least it would be if my friends weren't sick of talking to me about this stuff.
I'm right there with you, friends.
The rambling and off-topic moments are a feature, not a bug. Which I appreciate that as well. I actually, when this review came up, I screenshotted that and I tweeted it. Yeah, I tweeted it and I was like, this person gets it. Listen, if you too have a lack of weird conversation in your life. So thank you so much, Azur Talon Prime. If anybody wants to leave us a review, we are happy to read it out. And at the very least, thank you by your screen name, your username. Do people say the phrase screen name anymore? I don't think so.
What?
Anyway, that is all I have. You can find us on Twitter.
Isn't
at Not Alone Podcast.
A handle or something?
Yeah, yeah.
What's my Twitter handle?
Yeah,
Sam, I think what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, well, my Twitter handle is Beer Lord Elfbane. Jason, what's your Twitter handle?
Mighty Moit.
And our combined Twitter handle that's still just me is Not Alone Pod. But
because he is alone. Whoops.
Sad.
Did I say that yet?
You can also find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. You can join our Facebook page, our community, which is Remember We Are Not Alone, a community for the strange, where we post all sorts of great memes. That's the majority of that.
I posted one today.
Yeah, you did. It was a good one. I liked it. All these Area 51 memes, I'm loving them, guys. I don't think any of the celebrity things are true. I think those are all fake, but that's fine. It's whatever.
Even if it isn't true.
Who cares? Other than that, you can find us at notalonepodcast.com. You can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. And if you have stories you want to have included in our next listener special, which is just going to happen whenever I get enough stories, maybe I should say this at the beginning of an episode for once, you can email those stories to notalonepodstories@gmail.com. All right. It's episode number 103.
You're odd, I'm even.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Remember. Remember, whether you lay in an enemy camp, dying of scurvy, or you're just trying to get lucky in the woods under a full moon, you are not alone.